Hi, this is Steve Worona, and you're listening to the very first EDUCAUSE Live Spotlight on Identity Management. Before I introduce today's guests, here's a brief orientation to the technology we're using, an interface called Wimba Open Room. Your browser right now is showing the title slide for today's talk. In the lower left-hand corner of your screen is the word to, followed by a colon, and then a drop-down list currently displaying the word all. To the right of that drop-down list is a blank line where you can type a message. To send a message to the general chat area, first make sure the drop-down list does still say all, and then type your message into the blank line and hit enter. And that's how you'll ask a question or make a comment during today's session. Just send it to the general chat area, and we'll respond to as many of your messages as we can over the course of the hour. You can also send a private message to anyone else that's logged on. To do that, just select the recipient from the drop-down list before typing your message. One of the names you'll find in that list right now is EDUCAUSE Help. If you run into any technical problems, send a private message to that name and they'll assist you. And finally, if you missed part of today's conversation or if you want to see some or all of it again, all EDUCAUSE Live events are archived on the EDUCAUSE Live website, including both audio and video. Feel free to come back as often as you like. We also have a copy of our speaker slides linked from the webpage for this EDUCAUSE Live session. And now to today's webcast. Each of these monthly Spotlight on Identity Management events will feature two speakers from a campus that's analyzing or solving an identity management problem in a way that we think you'll find instructive. Today my guests are from Cornell University, and we'll hear first from David Yeh. David is the Assistant Vice President for Student and Academic Services at Cornell, and he also serves as the university's registrar and its Ivy Student Athlete Eligibility Officer. In these roles, he's been collaborating with colleagues on a variety of innovative technology initiatives for many years, going back to a time before the Internet existed when he helped introduce online student and faculty self-service utilities through Cornell's groundbreaking Project Mandarin. He also took the lead in Cornell's deployment of the PeopleSoft Student Information System, in the creation of Cornell's multifunction digital ID card, and in transforming the university's matriculation and registration process from paper to paperless. David's a member of the Board of Directors of the National Student Clearinghouse, where he serves on its Executive Committee and chairs its College Advisory Committee. David earned degrees at the University of Illinois at Chicago and at New York University. He's worked in higher education and medical education for more than 30 years and has also worked as a park ranger. David, welcome to EDUCAUSE Live.
Thanks, Steve. It's a pleasure and honor for us to participate in today's EDUCAUSE Live Spotlight on identity management. I always have some fear and trepidation about such public presentations, as there's always this perception that somehow we've got it all figured out. The point is that we haven't, and here at Cornell, one of the things that's happening is that this is an evolving process. This is a journey, and we're learning and changing as we advance. And the one thing I want to emphasize is the word advance and the word collaboration. Yes, we have shared secrets, a shared vision, a shared governance, and shared technologies across our business functional areas as well as in our collaboration with our technology colleagues. From a shareholder and functional area perspective, these are four very critical components in support of identity management and a number of other business needs which we have in a complex organization like Cornell. While my role and responsibility relates to students in the Office of the University Registrar, we really serve a broad institutional role as well. So as Steve mentioned, we issue the university's ID card, which is really the physical focal point about identity, and that touches many points of access and services. We've approached this from a individual's life cycle perspective, starting as an applicant, and at some point we've talked about even starting with the alumnus or an alumna's infant, but that's really getting ahead of myself and Andrea today. Another key component is policies and procedures. In my mind, this is the structural underpinning for very strong operating protocols and principles, and really provides a structure whereby we then can operate. Operating within a shared database environment, we have a ERP, which is PeopleSoft. We've come to realize that we've been shielded from some very basic issues. And now we've learned by stumbling, picking ourselves up, and dealing with such issues as shared names, shared addresses, and even shared secrets. The issues of privacy and security stare at us as we've never had to deal with before. And I'm sure that that might be the same case for many of you. Sharing technology infrastructures helps support common practices. It's also important because it helps to reduce costs, redundancies, and in fact, some conflicts. We're all at the same table, and whether it be our IT colleagues in working on infrastructure or looking at business processes, my colleagues in human resources, finance, budget and planning, and alumni all address and deal with some of the same common issues and try to resolve and come up with a common solution. And the other aspect that's been very important is on the business side, we've had to learn to be technology aware and technology smart because this is not just an IT consideration. From a life cycle perspective, we look at students from the time they become applicants to the time they matriculate into a degree program. As they turn into alums, they graduate, they might return as employees, and we even consider friends of Cornell, who might be guests on campus, in the same life cycle perspective. And having a common provisioning process and protocol becomes very essential, rather than having one set of protocols for one group and then another for a different group. And this is very important as we carry across our programs on a global basis, whether it be in the Middle East, in Asia, Africa, and Europe. And it's not just in Ithaca that we're concerned about. Simplifying our connection with other people in the community is very, very essential. We need to be able to establish who, what, and how student access and information is accessed, be it here in Ithaca or in one of our programs overseas. Establishing then common approaches becomes very essential in dealing with very complex sets of issues. And we've had to deal with our other business partners across the functional areas in using the technology tools to advance in all of these endeavors. Similar processes really have helped ease the learning curve and also at the same time help us to address our security and our privacy concerns.
David, thanks so much for that background. We're talking to David Yeh, and in a little while we'll be hearing from Andrea Beezing. Both of them are at Cornell, and they're talking about how Cornell solved some issues in identity management. If you have a question or comment for David and later for Andrea, type them into that blank line at the lower left-hand corner of your screen, and we will present them during some pre-planned breaks that we have. David, you mentioned that there are a number of folks participating in the governance structure, a number of stakeholders. Give us some idea of how those groups are organized. How frequently do you get together? Who's on the groups? What's your role? What's the role of the IT department?
That's a really great question, Steve. The governance process and structure extends from the president, the provost, our senior vice president, and our executive staff, our vice presidents. And then there are a number of directors, assistant vice presidents, who then take on an operating or a delegate role. When I talked about us all being at the table, I'm speaking now of all the major business functional areas, HR, finance, planning and budget, facilities, sponsored research. I represent student, and also my colleague from Alumni Affairs is also at that table. And we share two particular processes, two particular structural components. One is on the policy side, where we're deliberating policies and developing them, and those are then promulgated into practices. We then also look at our IT applications and technology innovations. This is where Andrea and her colleagues in our central IT shop play a very vital role, because as they're developing new technologies, we're considering, well, how do we use it on the one hand. On the other, we're also deliberating and discussing business practices and needs, and they're then in return looking at how they can develop technologies that can help us achieve our objectives. The identity management component is a really vital one that we've been working on collaboratively across the functions and also with our IT partners.
And how often does this, should I call it a policy group? What do you call the group? How often do they meet? How large is the group?
Our policy group actually meets once a month, and then there are separate working groups. I serve as the data custodian and data steward for student information. And in that role, I have to determine who may access the data, who may use it, how it's used. And I work very closely with our IT security on issues of security on the one hand, and we're now beginning to grapple the issue of privacy, which is a really separate issue. On the administrative computing side, which is a very vital component of the governance process, we actually meet once a month to set priorities for various projects, where resources are going to be directed, what are the projects we have on the docket. We look at both long-range and short-range planning. We're in the midst of a 10-year planning cycle, and then that gets broken down to a 5-year, and then we do a 1-year, and we are accountable to the provost for how we collectively have spent that money in terms of deliverables. And of course, one of our primary customers are the colleges, both faculty and students and other administrative offices on campus. So it's been a very dynamic and very challenging, but I think a very rewarding structure that we've put in place that, it's constantly evolving and it's being refined as we move forward.
I'm going to slide in one more question during this break that came in from the audience. Did you say that Physical Plant was one of the stakeholders? If so, what part did they have a stake in?
Well, Physical Plant is a very vital part in terms of our looking at another university resource. Just as information is a resource that the university needs and uses, so is facilities. And facilities is not just the buildings, but the entire campus. They're very vital on the academic side, because I work very closely with them in our concerns for classrooms. The researchers are very concerned about the facilities insofar as research facilities. And it's not just buildings, but also grounds. And that plays into our capacity, energy capacities and load. The other aspect in the facilities arena is that risk management and public safety report in. And with the onset of all the concerns about emergency planning for, be it disasters or for pandemic planning, they play a very vital role in terms of how they provide an undergirding infrastructure for the campus to run. And so they play a very vital role. And they use HR and student and other data. So they're a very key component in terms of how we need to work together. Because ultimately, we're talking about how do we use information and share it from one department to another, as well as within different organizations at Cornell and also our business partners outside of Cornell.
Thanks, David, and we do have a couple of other questions that have come in. I will save them for the next break. In the meantime, I'll let you get back to your presentation at slide 5.
Linking people and services is very vital, and I think what is very important that we share in the higher ed community is that it's really based not on the premise of a 9-to-5 set of parameters, but it's really anytime, anywhere, And one of the things that's even more vital these days is that the data and the information that we pass along and the transactions we're all involved in is accomplished in a secure manner. And this is where we are really adopting the notion that using common tools, middleware in this case, to enable the intra and inter-institutional links will really facilitate services and access on this notion of anytime, anywhere. And I extend the notion of this linkage beyond, you know, the confines of Cornell University, because in many cases on our research side and also on our educational side of the house, that extends to faculty who are at other institutions. We have instructors, they may not be faculty, they may be instructors who are in the corporate world that provide internships, externships, and learning opportunities for our students. And there are many other business partners that provide services for universities like Cornell. The Interlibrary Loan Service is very vital, and it's taking advantage of the technology tools from In Common. And, you know, that's something that we want to advance with many of our business partners, such as the National Student Clearinghouse and other services, because that's going to only help them and us be assured about the security of, and passage of the data that we vitally use. And that's really a key issue, is improving our management of risk. We hear every day about the issues related to privacy and security. They're on everyone's mind, and it's not just the lawyer's issue. It's an issue that we face on the business side. It's very, very important, and I know that here at Cornell, on our information technology, our chief security officer is quite concerned, not just about the security, the kind of security infrastructure, but also the issues of how do we assure privacy for protected data. And because our institutions are very, very complex, and I might say very decentralized, I mean, that's kind of the nature of higher education. We've got to be able to have operating systems and infrastructure that provides efficient and reusable kinds of tools. Otherwise, we're going to be taxing ourselves in so many different ways. And as we are, even now, global organizations, you know, our campuses and our programs are no longer just here in Ithaca or wherever yours might be. The fact is that our ability to cross different time zones has become even more essential. And it's not just service delivery, but it is, as I said earlier, the issue of security and protection of information, which is a vital university resource. So, reusing and extending, having extendable tools become very essential in our building this particular infrastructure, because it is a fast moving train, and we are having to be living with, we are having to really have policies which are living, and our need and ability to be able to make changes becomes very important. Provisioning of identity is just the beginning, but then, as I've indicated, common policies and practices become very essential as we really have to be able to use technology in a very different way and changing our business practices because of changes that might be surrounding us. We want to learn from your experiences, both the practice and the policy, as we collaborate and as we advance on this interesting journey.
Thanks, David. Someone wonders, can you speak of the challenges of policy and planning for development of identity management for internal as well as external implementations?
That's a very interesting question, because I just came from a meeting this morning where we talked about internal challenges of policies. not having been in a shared database environment, we did not realize the many times in which we are stepping on one another's toes. I mentioned, for example, names and naming conventions. But one of the issues that we've come up with is two data elements, Social Security number and a date of birth, which we are all very concerned about, both its privacy and its security. But you can imagine what happens when one area, let's just say HR, our human resource area, really buttons down and said, no, 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 you can't use that data and we can't have it displayed and so forth. But then as another area of the university, we'll just say our student area, we go into the same shared integrated system, and suddenly because at Cornell we distribute access to student information on a very broad basis, and many students are current employees, and many of them are alumni. And once we've opened up that shared environment, and you can, it's possible, then to see another person's SSN, what do we do? Our business practices and our needs are very different. And so I think that we've had to deal with these issues as they come up and realize that we're going to have to set up different practices and procedures. One of the issues, one of the outcomes of this conversation is that we may in fact have to have, for some common data, a privacy officer that will determine for the campus how certain data elements will be used, who will have access, etc. We couldn't have arrived at this point in agreeing to that decision had we not had a lot of conversation at a micro level over the course of the last several years. So that's one of the internal challenges. And so you can magnify that across campus where we're needing, or across institution, where we're needing to share vital information to one another. We have researchers who are collaborating. We need to be able to validate identity. How do we do that? And one of the opportunities, I think, is where we might apply the federated ID, ID management, that would then enable the verification of individuals without then going deep into private information. And so that's, I think, one of the challenges that we have within the higher ed community is how do we begin to address some shared issues? And I think that privacy of certain information is one of them.
David, you've several times used a three-word phrase that I think a number of people thought they might never hear in the context of higher ed, and that is changing business practices. I know on many campuses administrators show up at a table to discuss identity management or some other technology with the idea that the technology is going to be deployed and architect to support the business practice they already have, because they're sure not going to change their business practice. But it sounds like at Cornell you've got people who are willing to change their business practices. How did that happen?
Very painfully. I think that one of the aspects, and I've been a long-term champion that the way you do business in the paper world and how you do it in the electronic world is fundamentally different. You've got a quantum change that has to take place, but one can't make that change in one leap. And that's one of the challenges, is that I think that as human beings we're not too fond of change. And so I think that part of the issue is how do we introduce change, and how do we help sustain it? One of the secrets is that one has to have a vision about how you envision the world to be in the future, and then you have to strategically plant little seeds and take very little steps, because some of those little steps will result in huge change. I think that we learned that when we introduced self-service using the Mandarin tools. that just transformed the way in which we had to think about serving students, their time, their sense of time, how quickly we then had to turn around information, and then who did that impact? The example I would share with you very quickly is that when we introduced students' ability to access their grades, what happened was that once grades were posted, the system, of course, looked at accessed the grades in the production system. Well, you know, in the olden days, when grades were submitted by faculty members, they knew they had a few days, if not weeks, before grades were posted, and then students would get a grade report at home. And they could, you know, leisurely take care of their own business, do their research, you know, be on their trip and not worry about calls from students about why their grades weren't higher. Well, when we first introduced the online access to students, well, for students to get their grades, faculty would get calls the same day. And that really shocked them. They said, how is it that you were able to find out your grades so quickly? We put them at a disadvantage, and what we had to do within the year was give faculty access to their advisees' grades, because they were like entirely shocked that students could have information and they felt disenfranchised. So it's really, this is a moving target, to be sure.
I'm going to squeeze in one more question before we move on to Andrea that'll give you another opportunity to present an example. Somebody says the HR example that you gave a while ago is an excellent example of where there are hurdles with sharing data. Once you agreed upon the shared data to be used for the purpose of validating person identities, how did you come to agree upon processes? Did you have to develop formal policy? If so, would you be willing to share them as examples? And I'm going to throw in another question there, and I'm wondering to what extent it was just a matter of taking the time to have people agree, or did you have to appeal to higher authority? Did you need to get a president or a provost or an executive vice president to come along and tell everybody to come to agreement on these things?
Well, going to your question specifically, Steve, it was certainly helpful to have our vice presidents, who are officially the data stewards of each of the respective areas, establish guidelines in terms of use and what we consider good practices. I think that because this group, my colleagues, my immediate colleagues in HR and alumni, finance, and so forth, have worked together for a very long time now, there's a high level of trust that we have with one another, and we have understood what the core issues were regarding what were the vital pieces of information, because they affect us personally too. And so there was no need in many ways to have a higher authority like a vice president say, or the president say, here's what you must do. I think that we intuitively had a sense of both integrity, but also an understanding of the vital nature of institutional resources like information, that we were able to coalesce a set of practices and policies. We'd be very happy to share, and perhaps Steve could help facilitate, a URL to our policy our policy site, which has all of our policies. Some of them are in process, some of them are interim, but a large number are coming through related to technology, data stewardship, and custodianship, which really sets the framework for then how do we implement. And I'd be very happy to share that, and I think Andrea and I would be happy to speak with you individually or collectively.
Thanks, David. And that gives me an excuse to point out that one of the features that we've introduced for the Spotlight on Identity Management series is a wiki that you can find out on the web, and we'll get that URL typed into the chat area. You'll also find it on the web page. But what we'd like people to do who are participating in this Spotlight series is to contribute their ideas and questions so that this can be an ongoing dialogue. And David, I do appreciate your willingness to participate in that. And now on to my next guest. Andrea Biesing is Assistant Director for Cornell's Identity Management Program. She assumed this position in November of 2001 when the program was first created, and since then she's been working with campus groups to align the Identity Management Program with the university's business needs and strategic direction. She has 17 years of experience in IT at Cornell, encompassing the areas of desktop support, voice and data network deployment, enterprise operations management, directory services, and authentication and authorization services. She holds a master's degree in Slavic studies from Cornell and received her undergraduate degree from the State University of New York at Albany. Andrea, thanks so much for joining us today.
To be here for the to christen this new important series. We're going to take a look at the identity life cycle of the student for more specific examples of how the business and IT sides of the house are collaborating at Cornell. Going to the next slide, I've listed some identity management goals for student services here. Providing students with the means to access authenticated self-service options and targeted information is urgent. It's one way to foster a very strong connection.
And Andrea, I'm afraid you're cutting in and out. I'm not quite sure why. If there's something you can do with your phone or speaker, try it again. You don't have to go back, but...
Okay. Maybe what I'll do is switch phones.
Okay, if you can do that quickly.
Is this better, Steve?
No, can't hear you at all.
Okay, here we are. Is this
okay.
Better?
Yes.
Okay.
Excellent.
So,
thank you.
One of the ways to foster this connection is to provide access to online self-service options and target information as soon as possible in the life cycle. Some of the examples of how we've gradually reduced the need for students to stand in line and spend some of the valuable time they have while they're on campus on administrative tasks is moving some of our paper processes to online self-service, which can be completed well before the students arrive on campus. So, for example, we allow them to sign up for a university housing contract or dining meal meal plan, as well as connect to Cornell's portal where they can get information that's specifically tailored for students or even to students of a particular college. One of the ways that we're looking at and protecting security and privacy is by extending the reach of our single sign-on solution to allow access not only to more services at the university but outside of the institution. And I would point to some of the work that's being done in the Federal Federation space for providing an infrastructure that allows for the possibility of not necessarily identifying a student to an external resource by name, but only as a student who is registered at Cornell University. So I think that's been very important, the progress that's been made toward federation. Going to the next slide, I'm talking about infrastructure in support of these goals. When approaching the challenge of making sure the right people have access to the right information anytime, any place, it's important to keep policy, business processes, and technology aligned at all times. They're very important components and they inform each other. I think that business process and policy should be the principal drivers for what we implement with technology, but they do inform each other constantly. On the top portion of the pyramid here, I've indicated some of the policies that we have at Cornell University that are relevant to identity management. And then in the left corner, I've talked about some of the business processes that go into delivering a solid identity management infrastructure, both business process and business areas that come into play. In the lower right corner, the identity management infrastructure services are represented. So at Cornell University, we have implemented all of these services in support of strong identity management. We have a very robust authentication infrastructure, a robust suite of services based on MIT Kerberos. In the authorization space, we have a group management tool that's been in place since the early 90s. We're in the process of enhancing our authorization services by implementing Grouper for group management and Signet for privilege management. These are two solutions that are being developed under the auspices of Internet 2. And one of the attractions to these services for us is the capability of providing, of delegating the authority to manage access to services. And this is very important in a highly decentralized environment like Cornell's. On slide 11, the student identity lifecycle here is simplified for the purposes of discussion, starting with the applicant all the way through to alumnus. I'm going to focus on three of the business challenges listed to the right. The last three, anticipating the future business needs, such as federated access to services, is very important for us here. Making sure that we follow business processes which align with standards issued by the National Institute of Standards and Technology has become important so that we don't implement identity management practices which will negatively impact our ability to participate in the federated space. It's out of the scope of this talk to get into any details about those standards, but I would encourage people to visit the federal e-authentication site and especially look at NIST Special Publication 800-63 for more information about these topics. There is also a wiki on the InCommon website that has good information about identity assurance. The concept of identity assurance is becoming more important when we talk about access to different types of information, the level of assurance of the identity becomes very important. Further, the understanding where business processes and organizational changes might be needed is important. So for example, some institutions have implemented identity offices that are responsible, you know, one office that's responsible for identity. At Cornell University, we've implemented an identity management program in the IT organization, which is responsible for managing the technology and the services that deliver identity management to the campus. Slide 12. The next two slides here, I'll drill down.
Okay, sorry, Andrea, this is where we had planned to take a break, so let me dive in here at the end of slide 11. Or would you like to, would it be better to go on to 12?
I think this is a good break point.
Okay, good. So I was wondering, so we had David tell us about sort of the administrative structure, about how policy is taken care of. I'm wondering if you can say something about who all is involved in making these various technical decisions and how you interact with the policy people. And I'm going to put slide 10 back up because I think perhaps that might be a good basis for illustrating how the communication flows.
That's a good question. The IT staff has regular conversations with a number of business staff. We quite often attend the regular meetings of the governance groups when there is a topic that requires some input from the IT organization. We also, if there's an IT policy that's being developed that is in the area of identity management that touches on that particular area, the IT staff do play a very important role in helping to develop the policy, so that it actually makes sense from a technical point of view as well as a business point of view. So there is participation among the IT staff in developing IT-related policies.
Someone asks, how did you end up establishing trust and delivering the initial password? And is it the same process for all people, students, staff, faculty, alumni, et cetera?
Yes. I do go into this in a little bit more detail in the next few slides. But one of the things we've done is implement a one-time activation code, and we are very careful about the way we deliver the activation code for the NetID, which is the ID that the student, staff, and faculty and alumni use. So we don't deliver those electronically, but it's a one-time activation code, and it expires after a certain period of time.
I'm going to put slide 11 back up because when I was looking at your student identity lifecycle, what struck me that among your business challenges you didn't list, and somebody has asked about this, the idea that, some people have multiple roles. David pointed out that a lot of students are employees and students are alumni, so the question that came in is how do you handle individuals who have multiple identities and roles, e.g. students who are GA's graduate assistants?
That's a very good question. That is actually one of the business challenges, and I think I had it listed on that slide.
I missed it.
It's very often, as David mentioned before, that an individual has more than one relationship with the university. So as we look at life cycle changes, as let's say this is a good example, if a student moves from, graduates and becomes an alumnus, he is no longer eligible for licensed library materials. But however, if that person is also an employee, he should have access to that information based on the fact that he's an employee. So we have to be very careful as we look at life cycle practices that we're taking into account all the relationships an individual has with the university. And that is actually one of the challenges of automating some of these processes, because you have to constantly you have to have a very full understanding of all those relationships and what they mean, and where the data is that represents those relationships.
And you must be depending on the people in David's group to let you know what those limitations are. I mean, the IT people would tend not to know themselves that that a student who is an alum gets a certain set of privileges unless that student alum also has to be an employee, and so the employee relationship trumps the others. This must be very difficult to graph out.
Yes. One of the things that we've started to work on, and this is under the auspices of the Administrative Computing Governance Group, is look at developing a mapping between our groups that we serve, our constituent groups as I refer to them, and service entitlements. So that's actually been quite a time-consuming effort to really look at across the full range of relationships that people can have. And if you look just at the student identity life cycle, you see a lot of stages there, and they're probably not all represented there in this slide. There is a level of complication in representing all those groups and then mapping them to the multitude of services that we have available on campus.
I'm going to slide in one more question before I let you get back to your presentation. The question came in, how big is the identity management staff? And I'll throw in a wrinkle on that. How is the staff distributed among the central IT group and among all of the various other IT groups across campus?
Right now we have 8 staff in the identity management group in the central IT organization, with me as the assistant director being 9. There really are not people designated across any of the other IT groups or functional areas as specifically focusing on identity management, although in fact we do draw quite heavily on a number of people across the different IT groups as well as the functional areas as we implement new services.
Okay, thanks.
In many ways, identity management becomes an issue that we share across, especially the central business areas, and our working very closely with Andrea and her team is very vital, because no single group can do it alone, because it's a very dynamic and fluid organization.
Thanks, David. So, Andrea, I'll let you get back to your presentation at slide 12.
Great. In the next couple of slides, I'm going to talk in a little bit more detail about the applicant onboarding process, how we brought the applicants into the centrally maintained identity lifecycle. This is some work that we did fairly recently, and talk a little bit about how the decisions were made. So on the left side, I've represented some of the business needs that were identified during the course of the project. Some of the players are listed below that. That list isn't exhaustive, but I was trying to be as representative as possible. And on the right-hand side, I talk about some of the business decisions that were made. I want to talk about a few of those and just highlight a few. One of the discussions we had was whether an applicant should get a NetID, And that's the net ID is the sequence of letters and numbers that we assign to staff, faculty, and students, as well as alumni. And it's issued to that individual for life. It's never reused. Our interim authentication policy actually states very clearly who is entitled to a net ID, and it does cover community members. So there, you know, we of course could have gone back and changed our policy, but after a lot of discussion, it became clear that the best thing for us to do would be to create a new type of ID, which would be an applicant ID, that would be unique but temporary for that application cycle. There was also a lot of discussion involving, in particular, the Director of Undergraduate Admissions, the Data Steward, and the IT Security Director about access to information based on the fact that the applicant ID was emailed and password was emailed to the applicant. And we didn't feel that the identity assurance was high enough. There was a feeling that there was some risk involved in providing online access to the financial aid award. So consequently, that requirement was put aside for the moment until we have the opportunity to really look at other ways we can increase the assurance of that identity before we release that information online. So that's an example of where the IT organization and the data steward and the business leaders collaborated to make a decision to address perceived risk and then move on you know, strike a balance between business and security. Proceeding on to slide 13. The next stage in applicant onboarding is, I wanted to tell you a little bit about what some of the IT concerns were and how those were translated into implementation details. Some of the security considerations I've listed on the left here. We did decide to create a separate Kerberos database, separate realm, for the applicant IDs, and this was largely due to the fact that we wanted to make sure that our identity assurance for the net ID was consistent in light of some of the arrangements that we'd like to get into with federated partners. Make sure that that was a higher level of assurance and that we didn't mix a lower level of assurance identifier with this. As I said before, we issued a one-time activation code. We created a self-service application that would allow the applicant to activate and manage the password. So we provided a function to reset the password if it was forgotten, avoiding a lot of calls and, you know, emailing of activation codes around the country and around the world. We also created a group and the capability of creating groups so that campus service providers could offer access to applicants to their applications as appropriate. Allowing the campus service providers to create their own groups allows them to be more selective. So for example, if someone from the hotel school wanted to provide targeted information for hotel applicants, they could do that. Proceeding to the next slide, the next step in the student life cycle, onboarding the student, on this particular slide, I want to focus on the decision that was made regarding the need for students to be aware, make sure that the students were aware of IT policy and their responsibilities prior to their use of our services. And it was a very strong business need. So the players that I've listed here, there was a lot of discussions, a lot of campus meetings, and eventually the outcome was that a decision was made to require students to take a tutorial and quiz regarding this topic prior to activating their net IDs. So that was a business process that was put in place, and it was considered a success to the extent that it was then extended to staff and faculty as well. So that's a really good example of a shared business process. And on slide 15, Since a picture says 1,000 words, it's put together this simple architectural diagram and to show how the components of the infrastructure fit together to provide a means for the student, represented by NetID RFC 32, to access a wide range of services both on campus and off campus using the NetID and password. On the bottom, the orange box, policy and business process, is the foundation for the IT infrastructure. The blue boxes there represent the IT infrastructure in support of identity management. The services that are listed in blue are in place at Cornell right now. The services listed in red are either in development or planned. The gray boxes, both on top and to the far right, represent the wide world of services that are available to the student by virtue of the fact that we have this infrastructure in place. On the right side, we have a service called ILLiad, which was recently implemented using federated access. This allows students to go to an external partner to request an interlibrary loan without having to re-authenticate with a different ID and password. So we're expanding the use of our NetID and password outside of our institutional boundaries, which is a very important goal for us. And within the near future, I'll expect that there will be more solutions listed in that far right box. We are in a number of discussions with different vendors and partners to accomplish the federated access to resources, just as we did for ILLiad. Delivering identity management to support intra-campus service delivery is very important. But extending this capability to intra-campus services and to external business partners is what I think of as the gold ring that we want to keep in our sights as we build this identity management infrastructure. Because ultimately, we have to be able to collaborate with institutions outside of our own, and we can't necessarily implement and support all these services ourselves. And proceeding to the last slide, this was just a way of illustrating that this infrastructure is in place. It works for students, but it will also work for any member of the community with a NetID.
Thanks, Andrea. Let's pick up some of the questions that have come in. A detailed one, how granular is your access policy and mapping defined? There's application access and then data access, and they're not necessarily the same thing.
Yes. Right now, the mapping, this global mapping or this sort of master mapping that we're working on is really on an application by application basis. And actually, David may want to add to that. One of the, as far as the granular access, but one of the tools that we're looking very closely at is Cygnet, which is a privilege management solution. And that's where we believe that we will accomplish better visibility and better management of that more granular access to data.
Yeah, as a result of our implementation of our PeopleSoft student, and in particular our DataMart, we, because it is very distributed across campus to the department level, we've had to work very closely on identifying how do we distribute access to sets of data and information to people in different roles. And this is where working with identity management becomes very important in ensuring that the infrastructure is going to, you know, create support that authorization. It's less about the authentication side as much as the authorization. And I think that this is an area that we're going to be exploring more and more as we see how especially the student data mart gets implemented on a much broader basis than we've had in the past.
Andrea, how do you handle other relationships, that is, non-employees such as ROTC professors or consultants who need access to systems or spouses who need to pick up children at the child preschool program and the like?
Yeah, this I know everybody faces these challenges. We do have a category of user or constituent that we refer to as exception with sponsor. So that if an individual is doing work that furthers the mission of the university, we do have a process where they can obtain a NetID and get access to some services. It's a limited set of services, and it's on an as-needs basis according to the role. We have some limited guest capability. We've implemented that on a very limited basis for just certain applications, but anticipate that we will have to roll that out for the entire campus at some point. But one of the things we want to make sure is that we have in place the policy and the understanding and the documentation and standards so that people know when they start issuing guest IDs that they know what information and services are appropriate to offer to guests and which aren't.
Analogous to the applicant ID, do you have an ID for faculty who've been hired but may not have arrived on campus, who have been hired and may have arrived on campus but haven't reached the contract start date and so they're not officially employees?
Right now we do have a process where we can issue net IDs and provide access to hires if the requisite paperwork has been processed. So, it can be issued prior to the date that they arrive on campus to start working.
We've only got a couple minutes left, and I'm going to try to squeeze in a whole bunch of questions. David, Andrea is talking about the quiz about network IDs that was given to students and I guess is being extended to faculty and staff. Prior to Andrea's mentioning that, though, this question came in that might be related. How do you promote and teach the importance of identity management in the hearts and minds of the users, especially students, who may not yet have developed an appropriate attitude toward protecting their identity credentials?
Well, I think it's a very slow and arduous process in light of such social applications like Facebook, where the sense of openness and freedom seems to pervade. It's only when they begin to realize that people are going to be tracking them down. For example, they get crank emails from people they don't want, that they come and say, gee, I wish I could, suppress my identity here. And so we're using those learning opportunities for students to be much more attuned to protecting their privacy, but also what it is that's online. It is a very, very challenging task. In this, given the undergraduate culture that we are experiencing.
Andrea, several people are wondering, wanting some details about what identity management software you're using, Sun, IBM, Oracle, et cetera. What can you say about that?
Yeah, we're using a collection of what probably would be described as best in breed open source plus some commercial software. So we don't have one of the identity management suites that we've deployed, but we have MIT Kerberos for authentication. We have some homegrown tools for authorization. So, group membership, very simple. We have a SunOne directory in place, and some tools that we've developed ourselves in-house to provision, to create net IDs and establish the group membership and the initial directory entry for that individual. So it's a combination of tools that have really developed incrementally over the years. We've built upon, the MIT Kerberos core over the years.
So this one, we've only got a few seconds, but I'm going to squeeze in this one question because it's the $64,000 question. It says, this is a lot of data and systems to support this data throughout the life cycles. Has this significant change in business process, data acquisition, and the costs associated with housing and managing this data netted a positive result? In other words, Has it been worth it? Andrea.
Well, I think that when I look at how Cornell has been able to achieve a really, really strong single sign-on solution for the community members, this is not to say that we don't have challenges that we haven't addressed yet, but I think that we have built something that is very strong that we can build on, and I've seen situations where we've been able to take advantage, and I'll point to the being able to use a federated approach to access to ILiAD as an example of where having this infrastructure in place was directly impacted our ability to move forward with that project. And I think that's where you're going to see the gains and the benefits.
And David, do you think it's been worth it?
Oh, very definitely. It's allowed us to really, you know, move very quickly. We had student provisioning far earlier than we had applicant, but because of that, we learned a lot. And I think it's these learning opportunities that we have that we can then rebuild and take advantage and advance. And we're going to see that move much more quickly now that we've had some more experiences.
Thanks very much, Andrew. Thanks very much, Andrea and David. Thanks to all of our viewers and questioners from around the Internet. You'll shortly be receiving an email asking for your reactions and comments on this EDUCAUSE Live presentation. Please take a minute to reply to that message when it arrives. If you missed any part of today's event, or if you'd like to watch some or all of it again, you'll find both the audio and video in the EDUCAUSE Live archives later today, and you'll also find today's slides linked from the webpage for this EDUCAUSE Live session. Also, be sure to visit the wiki we've set up where you can describe how your campus is addressing some of the identity management challenges you've heard discussed today, and where you can compare your solutions to Cornell's. For details, see our Spotlight on Identity Management webpage. The next EDUCAUSE Live Spotlight on Identity Management will take place on Tuesday, February 5th from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Time, when we'll feature two more speakers from another campus that's doing exciting work on identity management. Watch your mailbox for details on that webcast. And also be sure to tune in next Wednesday, January 23rd, for the next event in our regular EDUCAUSE Live series. My guest will be Wendy Seltzer from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Wendy's talk is called Legal Threats, Chilling Effects, and Warming the Air. Please plan to join us for both of these upcoming webcasts. EDUCAUSE Live is a production of EDUCAUSE, the Higher Education IT Association. Our executive producer is Cynthia Golden. Special thanks today to Valerie Vogel. This is Steve Worona. See you next time on EDUCAUSE Live.